Hi, I'm David Reardon, and welcome to Integral Life. Today, I'm talking to Michael Zimmerman about a subject that has been very much in the news in the last couple of weeks and will continue to be a big story on the planet, and that is climate change. What it is, what can we do about it, and how do we hold this conversation in a healthy sort of way? So over the next couple of hours, we are going to go into detail about why this story seems to be so hard to get our hands around. There are many, many, many different opinions. There are certainly a lot of diverse views, and it's a very complex subject about what actually is happening on the planet and what we're going to do about it. We're also going to explore this through Michael's story, which started almost a year and a half ago when he decided to really take a look in detail at why this climate change issue was such a hard thing for people to comprehend. And it's actually been through his journey that a lot of what we're going to talk about today has actually emerged in the cultural conversation, particularly in the last month or so. We're also going to take a look at things like where the money goes, because this is not just a theoretical conversation, but we're about and to spend trillions of dollars on some kind of solution to something. And certainly there's a lot of suffering on the planet and a lot of different things like energy, hunger, disease, that we also have to deal with. So the question is where are we going to spend our time, energy, and money, and what is going to be for the best good of the most people on the planet? We'll definitely get into that. And we are going to give you hopefully enough information so that, and a checkbook, and so that you get to decide where you're going to land in this whole issue and where, if you had the power, you would actually be directing us to spend our time, money, and energy, and into which subjects, which also include climate change is a big one. So, Michael, I think it would be really important for people watching this to understand sort of the deepness of this inquiry for you as someone that has been in the environmental movement for over 40 years. So can you talk about sort of the credentials and the eyes that you look through over this last year and a half as you came to the conclusions that we're going to talk about today and what it means to you as an environmentalist and if there are concerns about that, what they might be?
Sure. Well, I've been teaching and writing about and also being active in various movements related to environmental problems for 40 years. I've written two books, the most recent one with Sean Esbjorn Hargens, the Integral Ecology book, and I've also edited a major anthology for university use. It's now in its fourth edition called Environmental Philosophy. And I've been interested in deep ecology and help get it going, ecofeminism, and all the varieties of environmentalism, both reformist and radical environmentalism that have been around and have come on the scene in the last 40 years. So I've been always very concerned about the natural world since I was a kid. Growing up in Ohio, I had a deep bonding experience, if you will, with the natural world in this little town I grew up with. We had glacial cliffs behind the house and creeks and farm fields and forever. I mean, and I spent a huge amount of time outside just being with nature, if you will. I had kind of a Wordsworthian experience, and that's really still with me. So I really still appreciate the natural world in that way. And I don't like when I see whole forests wiped out or streams poisoned or human beings harmed as a result of environmental degradation. So I want to make clear that I'm an environmentalist, and I'm concerned about the future of environmentalism in relationship to what's happening around climate change. Because here's my big worry, and I talked to you about this when we first started our conversation, that if, as I started to suspect, as I started looking into this matter, the climate science itself became increasingly shaky as it got more and more scrutinized. And if, in fact, it turned out that CO2 was not as bad a bad guy as it's been portrayed, then the environmental backlash that could follow from that would have a very serious effect on environmentalism in general. This would be another case of the boy crying wolf or chicken little, the sky is falling. And I didn't want that to happen. I think it's happening to some extent. And I don't think the outcome's going to be good for environmentalism. And I think that would be very, very bad. On the other hand, this is an invitation for environmentalism to grow up to some extent, to undergo a kind of a developmental move in order to not become so exclusively identified with a green position, but take seriously the concerns of modernity and industrialists and economists who emphasize the importance of growth, and then move to an integral position second tier, if you will, which takes a look at the values and importance of both those positions and adopts a more pragmatic approach, which attempts to negotiate the most effective outcome while learning to talk in ways that make sense to people from both of these camps. Instead of making one the bad guy and the other the good guy, recognize the concerns of everyone, but not just limited to greens and industrialists. What about all these people in the third world, so-called third world? What about people who don't have any quality of life at all? What about those people? I mean, how are they included in this conversation? There's a lot of talk about this, but unless we take economic development seriously, and economic development, which can be, we hope, as environmentally responsible as possible, unless that's taken into account, and unless we recognize the importance of bringing these people up to some kind of standard of living, as much as we're able to do, then I think we're just having a talk among Europeans and Americans. We're not really including everybody. There's a lot of people left out.
Right. So how would you respond to what may be a criticism of someone that watches this? Because one of the themes that we hear is that all legitimate scientists agree, ... and we'll get to what is being said that they agree about, mm-hmm. right? So the science is in, the whole question about climate change is proven, everybody's in agreement except for that, you know, small faction of people that are dissenters, but there always will be, and gee, they probably work for the oil companies too, don't they? Mm-hmm. Or something to that effect. But how do you respond to someone saying, well, are you a scientist? I mean, you say that you went on this journey and you looked at all these kinds of things, but how do you know? I mean, if you're a professor of philosophy, mm-hmm. even though you teach sure. environmental ethics, how do you look at this data and come up with different conclusions than all the brightest scientists in the world that are working on climate change? How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I think the current science of climate change, which emphasizes CO2, it may be right. I mean, because a lot of smart people have looked into this, and so there's good reason to give credibility to this. On the other hand, there are also a significant number of other very smart scientists who disagree with this hypothesis. And that's what I started finding out. In other words, I realized that these dissenting scientists, who are themselves highly credentialed, Richard Lindzen's MIT is a chaired professor of climate science. He may be the most highly ranked climate scientist in the world by some people. Willie Soon, who works at Harvard, is another big climate scientist. These guys were constantly pushing against the CO2. Hypothesis, saying, "Look, it's part of the problem, but don't push it so far. It's not the whole issue.
Not the only problem.
It's not the only way in which climate warming and cooling have taken place. CO2 has a role to play, obviously, but what is it? And are we going to put all of our eggs in this one basket? The problem, from their point of view, from the point of view of a lot of the dissenting scientists, is that the climate modeling, which has gone into the for the last 20 or 25 years with regard to CO2 and what role it may play in warming, is modeling. It's based on computer simulation. We don't have yet a lot of empirical evidence in place that directly shows the causal driving force of the CO2 rise. There's a lot of correlation and so on, but it's not so clear that is the only part of the story. Let me just add what the other parts could be. Changes in solar radiation.
From the sun.
From the sun. Yes. All right. So the sun could be a factor, and many people argue that, yes, it is a factor. In fact, I read recently an article which argued that, well, yeah, the sun used to play such a role, but in the last 30 years it stopped because CO2 changed everything. Now, again, you can imagine the dissenting scientist saying, wait a minute, that looks like a special pleading to us. Also, the importance of particulate matter called aerosols. Aerosols have an effect on the formation of clouds, and the percentage of clouds in the upper and lower atmosphere, they play a role in how much heating and cooling takes place. And there are many, many people who study cloud formation who point out that cloud formation is not taken into account adequately in the climate models. One reason is that it can't be done yet. We don't have the computing power. We don't have the resolution power. And they argue, some of them, that In fact, there's a negative feedback loop. As the warming takes place, your CO2 production, clouds show up, which tend to cool things off in a certain way. Now, this I found very interesting. I wasn't aware of this. Another one, another type of aerosol, is the type that precipitates out quickly in the form of black soot, carbon. Well, it turns out that a study came out yesterday. This is in the middle of December. A study came out which showed that the particulate matter, aerosols depositing themselves on the glacial areas and snow fields in the Himalayas, are the reason that there's shrinkage in those glaciers. It's that the temperatures there are 4, 5, 6 times higher than they should be according to the climate models. And that's because as this stuff lands, this black soot from all the dung-fired stoves and other heating devices and cooking devices in that whole Indian subcontinent, that makes changes the albedo, the whiteness, as it were, of the snowfields and glaciers. They absorb more heat. They melt faster. All right. So it's not so much climate change. It's a human activity.
Yes.
Now, the third in related areas, we've got the aerosols. We've got the solar issues and also how the Earth wobbles on its axis and so on. And that would be a change of land use, cutting down forests, planting crops, the development of giant urban areas. These also have climate change consequences. So it's not just about CO2. CO2 is a part of the problem. I would never say that CO2 is irrelevant. I mean, that's a position I think is untenable. But I also would be very cautious about saying it's the real problem, because then it leaves out all these other factors. And we're now seeing incredible, in fact, very high-level peer-reviewed journals, articles by significant scientists demonstrating that there are other factors changing the climate in addition to CO2. So we shouldn't be putting all of our eggs in a CO2 basket. Other factors have to be taken into account.
Right. And eggs meaning our time, our attention, and money.
And our money.
On one solution or on one idea rather than many. The other thing I think it's really important that you're pointing out here is, because this is something that we go through if you look at the news all the time or any time, mm-hmm. is that we see these pictures of the glaciers receding. We see the polar bear sitting on, you know, the ice floe sitting in what was once the Arctic Ocean and now is not. I mean, just water and predictions that we're not going to have ice in that ocean, you know, in our lifetime, which is always shocking to us. So we can see that. And so people say, well, can't you see that? And you go, yes, we can see that. But what you're saying is there may be a variety of reasons that is happening. So it's not, no one's saying that it's not happening. You can actually see it. Something is happening to the glaciers. The question, real question is, what is happening and why? And then based on whatever you believe about that, then where do you put your time, energy, and money into correcting whatever that problem might be? But it might not just be CO2. It may be something else.
Right. Well, one of the things that has come out in recent years, you know, that and one reason I get upset with some of the environmental organizations I belong to, and I belong to a number of them, is the use of the polar bear, another, you know, charismatic megafauna, as the term is, to describe the problem. Oh, look, the polar bear is just out on this ice floe in there. Well, I mean, there's something to that, but according to what I've been able to read, and you know, here's the issue about philosophers. I'm pretty smart. Mm-hmm. I can read articles. Mm-hmm. I'm not a climate scientist, but I'm somebody who can read the debate between climate scientists and have some grasp of what the issues are, mm-hmm. and also look at the credentials, and also understand the pressure of peer review and government granting to force a certain way of approaching a problem. I mean, I know about that from my field. Right? So, and I know it goes on in the sciences as well. But consider the fact that according to many experts who study the polar bear, their numbers have increased dramatically in the last 30 or 40 years. And that's because they stopped hunting them. Mm. Hunting has been dramatically cut back, and their numbers have increased greatly. They're not threatened. And moreover, no one knows what's going to happen to Arctic ice. You know, some people say, oh, it'll be all gone in 4 years. It seems unlikely. Other people talking about 2050 or 2080, perhaps it will disappear. But no one's in a position to we can make all kinds of predictions, but we have to wait to see how the predictions turn out in order to be able to assess the credibility of the models that were used to generate those predictions in the first place. Now, aren't we in a planetary emergency? Shouldn't we just go for it? Well, I don't think we're in a planetary emergency yet. I don't see that yet. Ross McKittrich, who's one of these one of the economists who worked on this famous or infamous hockey stick temperature model
that we saw in the Al Gore film.
That we saw in the Al Gore film.
That was the magic moment of that film when he went lifting up on the lift and said, "Yes, patterns, but look where we are now." That was the moment where everybody gasped in that film, including me when I saw it.
But that model has increasingly been debunked. Mm. Because one of the things we got rid of was the medieval warming period, in which during which time they were farming in Greenland. All right. Now, there was no CO2 causing that warming. And there even some of the climate modelers, the key players in East Anglia, where that ClimateGate scandal began to erupt, even they in their emails were saying, well, look, you know, the medieval warming period, we may not be really any warmer than that. It's possible that then what's driving that? Could it be, in addition to CO2, other factors that were in play then, and what were they? So part of the problem, it seems to me, is trying to find, and I'm a lay person, I'm not a scientist again, but I'm able to follow the argument and see why there is real cause for concern about moving too fast in one direction. I think we have to be more thoughtful about how we're going to proceed in the next 20 years. And the issues of, which we'll get into soon, about energy production and where we're going to get energy to begin with, that's another key factor here.
Yeah. Before we go there, let's talk about two other icons that you and I, or not icons, actually metaphors that are used a lot in this discussion. We've heard them. One is what we need to solve climate change is an effort like we did when we went to the moon in 10 years. Mm-hmm. That all we need to do is have the will. We got the stuff. We know how to do it. We just need, and we can get this done like we did with that seemingly impossible thing when Kennedy said, we're doing this, right? Going for it. Talk to me a little bit about the sort of how those two things compare. One is, we're going to put guys in a rocket ship, and we're going to send them up in some minor way to the moon. Huge achievement, right? We all watch them land and do the thing, but we haven't been back. Why is that? Because it's real difficult to do the next step, which is to actually put people on the moon and live there and so on. But we did get there, and we did get there in 10 years, and that was a particular, once we focused, we had a rocket, we had this, we just had to develop the guys to go in it, and they went, and they did it. How does that compare to you to the many moving pieces of what needs to be addressed within the climate change conversation, just in terms of weighting one effort versus the other?
Well, another metaphor people have used is the Manhattan Project.
Yes.
That was what drove the production of the atomic bomb. Right. It ended World War II, at least in Japan. And moonshots, another example, the Apollo program and so on. Now, there's something to that. I think, for example, with regard to finding alternative energy sources, we definitely need to be spending a huge amount of money, much more so than we're currently spending, because, in fact, we're going to run out of oil. I read recently that peak oil may come in 2020. And this is from a major international organization which tracks energy. Some say 2030, but it's coming, and we need to find alternative energy sources. Let me just make one point clear. There's one thing that everyone should agree on, and I think they can agree on, and that is we have to find alternatives to fossil fuels. No matter whether you're a green thinking the world's about to end because of fossil fuels use, or if you're a super hyper-modern industrialist who wants to keep the economy growing, both can agree we got to find an alternative to fossil fuels. One, because they think it's harming the planet. The other, because they recognize we're going to run out and people are going to need energy. So I think that's it, were I to start the conversation over, I would put energy on the table and say, look, that's a big problem in the 21st century. We're going to run out of this fossil fuel stuff. Coal is nasty. It's dirty. These huge piles of contaminated ash and so on. There's big problems with fossil fuels. And we need fuel in order to have the kind of lives we want. Not just fancy, super fancy lifestyles like we have in Europe and the United States and North America, but just for ordinary people elsewhere to have a decent level of living. They need energy. So everyone needs it. That's the big problem of the 21st century. I mean, I would identify that. That's a crucial problem because energy runs everything. It's going to make possible economic development, better education, overcoming of diseases, which should have been gone long ago in a lot of countries, which we don't have to worry about anymore. Energy will make all that possible. But without the energy, we're really in serious trouble. So that's where I think the focus of our attention should go.
Right. Now, and not unrelated to CO2, by the way, as well.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
Because if we actually make that switch, right, if we actually start going through that transition and CO2 comes down, there's nobody in disagreement that that's a bad thing.
That's right.
That we need to reduce it, right?
Even that's a disagreement.
Huh.
Because there are a number of people who argue, in fact, the current energy czar in the Obama administration 20 or 30 years ago was arguing that increased CO2 would be good for the planet because it would increase crop growth. I mean, he actually said this, all right? Now, he's right, of course. I mean, one of the things that NASA has shown in satellite imagery in the past 20 or 25 years as CO2 production has gone up, there's been a planetary greening. I mean, plants thrive on CO2. It's what they need to grow. In fact, greenhouses will put up to 1,000 parts per CO per million in greenhouses, 1,000 parts per million. Right now, we're at, 385 or 390 parts per million. Imagine a planet with three times as much as that. It would be a lot greener. Now, probably it would be warmer. According to some, not as warm as the current models predict, but it would be warmer. All right. Even today, we're in no position to say, really, why is this the best temperature to be at? It's not clear, you see, what a slightly warmer world, another degree or two, could also be beneficial to many people, would have negative effects for some, but maybe overall be beneficial. We're just not in a position to know that. But in any case, there's a win-win-win solution around decreasing use of carbon fuels and moving toward alternative energy.
Right. And so I want to stay with the metaphor thing for a second, because the moonshot or the Manhattan Project, I mean, as two examples, when we look at the climate warming issue and say what may be required to address that, even if we address it in a healthy way that you're suggesting, that it's more than CO2, that what's required in terms of all of us, in terms of behavior, in terms of changes in our lifestyle, in terms of some people are suggesting a fundamental change in the way in our economic systems. Why? Because we've fueled all of this growth off of having cheap fossil fuels available to us, and it scales well and so on. And if that has to change, then we're into a lot deeper issue. And if you look at something like the moonshot, or you let's stay there for a second. Did that require some planetary change to actually have the will to actually do that? No, we actually did this, right? I mean, we just said, look, we got to focus our energy, but we know how to do this. It didn't require agreement on the planet that was a good thing to do, right? Which is whereas climate change, as you said, you know, the developed nations, developing nations, all these different moving pieces is much more complicated. And what it may require from us is much more extensive in a change than it was to do a moonshot or even build an atomic bomb, even though there were ethical concerns about that. You know, should we use it? Should we not? No one knew the devastating power that we actually saw demonstrated. So I'm sure all those conversations went on, but still, we didn't need agreement from the rest of the world to do that. We were at war, and we just said, we're going to do it. And we did. So comparing those two things, I mean, these metaphors get used to, you know, kind of get the emotions running and saying, hey, this is positive. We can do this. See, we did these other things like that. So that's critical to me to look at the differences in those things that you've helped me see. But let's stay to the energy thing for a second, because we are sitting here in the middle of December of 2009, and right now everybody is in Copenhagen having the environmental conference. Obama is going this week, or I think today.
I think the,
is it today?
Because it ends this weekend.
Yes, and the Chinese premier is that they've said we're going to make pledges and all of this, but there has been a considerable amount of conversation this week in particular that those pledges only mean something if we're really willing to deal with the use of energy and, most importantly, the price of it and the cost of it, so that if you really want to get people to start reducing the CO2 by reducing their use on fossil fuels, it's going to have to be more expensive. And then, of course, you go, oh, my God, $5, $10 a gallon gas, what would that do to the economy? It's never going to happen if that's the only way we can do it. Can you just talk about that a little bit, about what you see in that? So this is energy, finance, what we have to change, and then all as it relates to the
climate
change.
That's good. I mean, one of the things with respect to the focused efforts of the Manhattan Project and the Apollo Project and so on, at least with regard to Apollo, you didn't have to have Nobel Prize breakthroughs in order to get the rocket ship to the moon. I mean, they had to develop a delivery system. You had to figure out how to, you know, do the fuel, and the astronauts had to wear their suit. But all this stuff was, it was either engineering problems. They didn't require, how should I say it, the type of breakthrough we really need in regard to alternative fuels. And I think that's the real problem. We don't have in place yet anything that can take the place of fossil fuels. All right, now we have nuclear fuels, but environmentalists don't like those. All right, I think we got to go to nuclear direction. I mean, that's something we're going to have to do, and it's not going to matter that people don't like it. And it does have this awful residue, and we're going to have to find a way to deal with waste. But if you compare the amount of waste generated by nuclear power plants to what's generated every day by all the coal plants around the world, really nasty stuff. It's not as nasty as radioactive waste, but it's bad. Then we have to really think about what's happening there. I want to read you something, though, that I find very interesting. Now, this is from Newsweek. It's an article written by Sharon Begley, who is one of their top reporters. And her article's entitled, "We Can't Get There From Here." This came out in March of 2009. She's interviewing Professor Nate Lewis from Caltech. And that's a smart guy. I mean, this is what he does. He investigates the amount of energy that we're going to need in the future. So here's what she says after interviewing Lewis. His numbers show the enormous challenge we face. The world used 14 trillion watts of power in 2006, and the term for that is terawatts. I love these big numbers. Now, assuming minimal population growth to about 9 billion people, slow economic growth, 1.6% a year, almost recession level, and unprecedented energy efficiency, improvements of 500% relative to current U.S. levels, and assuming that's worldwide, so we're talking about serious energy efficiency, all right, that goes into place, the planet will use 28 terawatts in 2050. That's twice as much now, and that includes this huge energy efficiency. All right. Now, to keep CO2 to 450 parts per million, we're not even talking about going back to 350, which is parts per million, which is a mantra of some people today, the most important number on the planet. 26.5 of those 48 terawatts must be zero carbon. No fossil fuel for that percentage. Now listen to this. That's a lot of solar, wind, hydro, biofuels, and nuclear, especially since renewables such as solar and wind currently kicked in 0.2 terawatts in 2006. Okay, and nuclear provided only 0.9 terawatts. Now we're talking about when you compare that to what coal and gas and oil kick in. All right. Are you a fan of nuclear? Sharon Begley asks. To get 10 terawatts, less than half of what we'll need in 2050? Think of this. Lewis calculates, we would have to build 10,000 nuclear reactors, or one every other day from now to 2050. Do you like wind? How about this? If you use every single breeze on the planet, you'll get 10 or 15 terawatts. Since it's impossible to capture all that wind, a more realistic figure is 3 terawatts, or 1 million state-of-the-art turbines. 1 million. And even that requires storing the energy. We don't have any way to store energy from windmills and from solar power plants right now. When the sun goes down or the wind stops blowing, no energy. So that means you're going to have online, ready to go, alternative, you know, fossil fuel or nuclear fuel plants ready to kick in when the alternative renewable energy kicks out. Finally, how about solar? To get 10 terawatts by 2050, calculates Nate Lewis of Caltech, we need to cover 1 million roofs with panels every day between now and 2050. All right. Now, what does that mean? I mean, this shows the scale of the problem of moving from a fossil fuel-based economy, not just in the U.S. and Europe, but now in China and India and elsewhere, because other countries are going to want to develop, to this alternative fuel economy, even if you include nuclear. We're talking about unimaginable amounts of investment that would have to take place. So, and the scenario I just sketched out, or that I'm relying on Nate Lewis and Sharon Begley to have sketched out for me, that includes huge efficiencies. Now, if our efficiencies are less, and they probably would be, then these numbers all go up. Now, we're faced then on this planet, if we're going to want to maintain something like a good, decent lifestyle for most people, even if it means some reduction in lifestyle for us, because energy is going to get more expensive, we're going to have to invest a lot of money in all kinds of energy. That's why these promises that are being made at Copenhagen or these pledges are not going to come true for a very long time.
And why is that?
We can't get along without coal. We can't get along without gasoline. We can't get along without
Because it
gas.
Becomes an economic factor. Because if really we were going to reduce our use of that, we have no energy in the
We don't have any alternatives.
Exactly.
The one alternative we have is nuclear. Mm. This is still taboo for a lot of people, but not in other parts of the world. Other places are building these plants. We could do a lot better job than to plant a 3 Mile Island, which caused the anti-nuclear backlash in the late 70s. But when you're talking about 10,000 nuclear power plants, I mean, that's pretty mind-blowing. And that would only provide a percentage of the energy needed. Again, best-case scenario in terms of efficiency. So, you know, what do we need here? That's what, you know, the current Secretary of Energy, appointed by Secretary Obama, indicated that we need several Nobel Prize-level breakthroughs scientifically in chemistry and physics in order to create the types of renewable energy that we're going to have. All right, now, so that's why I do think it's worth spending $100 billion, $200 billion a year at least, perhaps, on basic research and figuring out how, for example, to significantly increase the efficiency of solar panels and to figure out where to store that energy when it's not needed so it can be online. Ready to be used. Same thing with wind. Okay. Also, you know, how to make really safe nuclear power plants, and how to get rid of that or dissipate the contamination what's left after you use the uranium for producing the heat that drives the turbines. We have to be active on all fronts. There's no one place that we should put all of our baskets, certainly in terms of energy.
Well, and that goes back to this checkbook idea that this theme keeps right. coming up. If you had a checkbook, which we all do in our lives, and you say, all right, you got majority of things you got to spend money on, different categories and so on, rent, food, whatever, would you spend it all in one category? I mean, would you just say, well, the only thing that's important is rent here. Oh, by the way, we're going to starve because we'll have no food, no water, no anything else. Right. And no, the reasonable person would say, no, I basically budget and I spread it across. And also in terms of economic risk, where do I actually, do I put all of my eggs into one basket?
Right.
Or do I hedge my bets? I mean, do I say, look, that's CO2 is worth looking at and we do need to do certain things. But as you've said, energy may be the thing that is most on the table for us to deal with, which also helps with the CO2.
Absolutely.
Can, right?
Absolutely.
Can, right?
Absolutely.
Can, right?
Absolutely.
Can, right?
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Right?